Call the next case. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning again. In this appeal, Bertie Reed and I represent the administrator of the state in a wrongful death case. This appeal is about pleading and the right to a jury trial. As we've seen from the briefs, there are two ways in which a defendant can owe a duty. One is if the law imposes it. The other is if that defendant voluntarily assumes it. This case involves only assumed duties. There was no legally imposed duty that was pleaded below. From the language in the Burns case, we all know that the assumption of a duty is a fact question. Did the defendant assume a duty or not? The Irish Fleet Morris asked you to require more than just facts, more than just the allegation of a fact. They want supporting reasons, they want pleaded evidence, something that this court has never required in any context. In this situation, our rules and our jurisprudence don't require something beyond asserting that a fact is true. It would be true for legal conclusions if we were asserting those, but you've already said that whether a defendant has assumed a duty or not is a question for the fact finder.
So all you have to do is to plead the defendant assumed a duty, period?
I think that's correct from the
that's case. Not a camouflage conclusion of law?
Well, that would require, I think, rewriting the Burns case in order to say that there have to be something beyond the question of whether a duty was assumed in order to create a fact issue. That's exactly what the Burns case stands for. Now, we have more than that. We have plenty of allegations of fact in this case. So I don't know that the court needs to go to the question of something that bare in order to resolve
it. Isn't it like a sufficiency analysis? If no fact pattern could possibly create a legal duty without fact one or two or three or whatever, that's what a demur is for, is to end the case then.
I think that's what discovery is for. If you assert that there is a duty and the defendant doesn't think that there's a sufficient pleading to enable him to reach the issue, to enable him to affirmatively and intelligently defend it, then he can either, in theory, ask for a bill of particulars, but more likely ask for discovery to say what are the facts that you rely upon in order to make this conclusion.
But how do we deal with these cross currents? Because obviously both positions have a huge kernel of truth. No, you don't have to specifically plead every single micro fact. But on the other hand, no, you've got to plead something. You can't simply make conclusions of law and call every conclusion of law a fact. Somewhere in the middle is a reasonable ground, and the question is, does your case fit within it, right?
Well, in asking me right, you're asking me if I could agree with your underlying supposition, and I don't. I think that once you do allege something that we all know is a fact, vel non, it's either true or it's not, that's sufficient to set the issue up for adjudication. And if it's denied, then you have a trial.
So my supposition is right, under the approach that you're advocating, it would have been sufficient, even though you say you did much more. But you could have simply said, we're suing these two defendants because they assumed the duty to protect my client, period.
I think that would be correct, even though that's not the circumstances here.
Right.
I believe that is correct.
Wow, that's a... I mean, make every complaint basically just to have the brevity of an indictment.
The happy news I have for you is that you don't have to reach that issue in order to resolve this case, because we have vastly more. We have a paragraph 44 that includes a whole lot of detail as to things that they undertook to do, how they undertook to do them. In paragraph 27, we have allegations as to what they failed to do under these circumstances.
How does the second dispatcher have a duty, though, based upon the allegations of what the first dispatcher did or didn't do?
We made pleadings in the alternative. Paragraph 27G assumes that Morris did write down the warning and Tatum simply did not consult the log, and that would make her negligent and Irish Fleet liable. Paragraph 27I asserts that Morris did not do so. They've got the logbook. We don't have it. But that asserts that he did not record it, and so therefore Tatum didn't have any way of doing it.
But if he didn't have a duty to look at the log to protect the taxi cab driver... I mean, it sort of begs the question, doesn't it?
Well, we did assert that they had a duty. That there is an allegation in the complaint that they had a duty to do that as
right.
part of their undertaken duty to protect cab drivers, to warn them.
Again, it's my last question. I'm struggling with, honestly, the whole thing seems circular to me because, as I understand everything you're saying, it's very logical. It's just, to me, very broad, which is you don't have to really plead facts. The complaint doesn't need facts. You just have to complete your ultimate conclusion. There was no duty at common law for this, but they assumed the duty, defendants are liable, and then you go into discovery, none of the preliminary motions are applicable.
Based upon the changes that Virginia made in her pleading requirements back in the middle of the 20th century, I think that is a correct statement, that you don't have to go into detail as to here are the underlying facts below this fact. I think all you have to do is assert what the fact is in enough detail to enable the defendant to know what it is that you're asserting.
But of course, you know, that same argument has been made for decades, as long as you and I have been practicing, and the U.S. Supreme Court eventually said, you know, we never really said that. That was the assumption people made, but we never said that. It was really just a cultural response as opposed to a more legally analytical response.
I'm quoting some of this report, your judicial ancestors that said that many decades ago. But it is true that once upon a time, pleading was jousting, where parties had to use the most sophisticated means available, avoiding each other, in order for a defendant eventually to avoid the case proving to be at issue. But in this context, and since this court has noted it, it's a more liberal standard now. It's notice pleading. We're notifying you, you assumed a duty, you breached the duty, that caused us damages, and some level of detail sufficient to enable them to be able to respond to it. And by the way, when you say that was your last question, I will candidly say I don't believe you.
One more question.
May I ask you this? On Mr. Morris, is it 27I that keeps him in? In other words, if he did write this down and then his shift ended, it's hard to see what else he was supposed to do. But it's your alternative in I that perhaps he did fail to document that would be the problem with respect to him.
You've identified it. Now, well, I should mention one other thing, too, because this is important. The fact, the allegation that he was not on duty the next morning, I've assumed to be true, but that's not in the pleading. They've got to prove that, assuming they deny that. But the more fundamental issue is what you identified.
Well, but if another dispatcher... Well,
he could have been on duty sitting next to that dispatcher, in theory, but I'm not going to assert that as the reason for it. In truth, it is an alternative pleading. Either he forgot to write it down or simply refused to write it down, in which case he and Irish Fleet are liable, or he did write it down and Tatum refused to look at it, in which case Tatum and Irish Fleet are liable.
Understood.
Under either circumstance, Irish Fleet is liable. Its liability is broader than Morris's is in this case. What the defendant sought and got in this case was a premature ruling on an issue of fact. So in this case, this complaint spells out Morris's duties. He had to screen calls for danger. He had to identify those dangers for cab driver's safety, and he had to warn and document. If he failed to do that, then he's failed to meet the standard, the duty that he undertook to do. I'll mention a brief thing about supplemental or superseding cause. If they are right, and essentially what they're asking you to rule is that all criminal activity is by nature unpredictable and unforeseeable, then there can be no liability regardless of the source of duty in a case like this.
That one, if the duty is to warn of the criminal activity, then it's more problematic than anticipating something that's very difficult to anticipate.
I understand that, and the duty was to screen for these kind of dangers, identify the dangers, and to warn. If they are right about this, then that would wipe Burns and Kellerman and Tabota, too, off the pages of Virginia reports. Because in all those cases, there was ensuing criminal activity that resulted in the tort damage to the plaintiff. Foreseeability here was a triable issue. In fact, we've asserted that Morris foresaw it. It was not merely foreseeable, it was foreseen. And that makes it a jury issue. The court shouldn't have taken it away. May I have leave to respond in the time remaining to me?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm John Merritt, and I represent Irish Fleet. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for Mr. Morris's counsel to argue his points. There's two avenues this court can take to uphold the trial court's decision. Number one is to find that the plaintiff failed to plead facts to support her legal theory that Irish Fleet undertook a duty to warn. The court can also decide that a depraved heart murder by a third party who intentionally shot Mr. Amrister 3 times in the head and neck is a superseding cause of Mr. Amrister's death as a matter of law. With regard to issue number one, the complaint does not give notice of what facts the legal conclusion that Irish Fleet assumed a duty. There are no facts. There are no factual allegations. Factual allegations are necessary and required to establish the existence of a duty of care.
What kind of factual allegations in the case law do you think have to be mentioned to at least plead a prima facie duty to perform and assume duty reasonably?
Well, in every single assumption of duty case that this court has determined that there was a duty assumed or determined that a duty could exist, there is a clear communication. There's a clear communication. Whether it be the first case in 1980, the Nolde case, where one driver gestures to another, there's a communication. It followed up with medical malpractice cases, Didato, there's an alleged communication. In Kellerman, you're all familiar with that case, there's a communication. There's a communication by the father that says, no kids in cars, no inexperienced drivers, and there's a communication by the mother who says,
communication by the party charged with the assumed duty and the alleged beneficiary of the duty.
Yes, and it's that communication that identifies what the duty is. And in this case, undertake doesn't tell you anything. Paragraph 44 contains no facts. It just talks about undertaking services. Undertake is synonymous with assume a duty.
We have a dispatching service that works for the taxi cab company, which employs or is an independent contractor relationship, the drivers.
In this case, the allegation, I believe, is that Mr. Amherster was not an employee of Irish Fleet.
Okay, so is there any allegation that could be reasonably inferred that either of the two defendants assumed a duty directly to this beneficiary, alleged beneficiary of the duty?
I would say no, Your Honor. There are no allegations that any dispatcher or any employee of Irish Fleet communicated anything to Mr. Amherster.
What about, I mean, you focus on paragraph 44, which I understand, but then typical fashion, the complaint incorporates by reference the preceding allegations in the earlier parts of the complaint. So we don't necessarily we're not limited to paragraph 44. And in those other allegations, they talk about, well, it appears there's a contractual relationship between the cab Mr. Armbruster worked for, the cab company, and Irish Fleet, and that they had this practice of warning of dangers, et cetera. Why can't we extrapolate from that they had assumed a duty to warn?
Well, again, I think you're referring to paragraphs 26 and 27, and there's nothing in those facts that even suggests that there was a communication between Irish Fleet and any of its cab drivers that we will warn you, we will do these things for you. There's no allegation of that. And there's no
Did they have to specifically warn them, or could it be based on their prior behavior? Mr. Morris did call off one dispatched cab driver the night before because his perception of the danger. So if there's an inference that the dispatchers are calling off drivers because of a perceived danger, why isn't that a communication sufficient to satisfy the communication you're seeking?
In all of the cases, Your Honor, that this court has decided, there's a clear verbal communication. It is verbal. This is what I'm going to do for you, or this is what I'm asking you to do, and I will do it. There is a clear, crystal clear communication in all of these cases that's not here. So Mr. Amherster, he's not aware of anything that happened the night before. And there's nothing ever communicated to him that Irish Fleet is going to warn him, they're going to protect him, or anything of that nature. And back to paragraph 44, undertake. Again, undertake doesn't say anything. And to use an example, if one of your sons or daughters were to ask you if they could go on a ski trip this weekend, and you asked them, have you prepared for your exam on Monday? And they said, well, I undertook to prepare. Well, they have told you nothing. They haven't told you whether or not they've prepared. And that's the same issue in this case. Has Irish Fleet assumed a duty? All they've pled is, well, you undertook to do these things. But it still begs the question, have we assumed the duty? And that's why you need facts. And those are the facts that are missing in this case. With regard to Burns, I would submit that Burns does not mean what the plaintiffs want it to mean. It doesn't mean that all you have to plead is assumption of duty and you get a pipeline to a jury trial. If that was the case, the holdings in Kellerman, Fruderman, and A.H. versus Rockingham wouldn't exist. In Kellerman, this court said that the mother who was a party to the conversation, who said, we'll take care of Jamie Kellerman. She assumed the duty by having that conversation. But the court also ruled that the father, the host father, who was not there at that conversation, did not assume a duty. And so the court ruled at the demurrer stage that the father did not assume a duty.
Despite the fact that the allegation was, yes, he did. And despite the argument, and that's a pure fact question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Exactly. And same with Fruderman. Fruderman was a case where there was actually a judgment in favor of a father. It was a father and mother suing a pediatrician. And the judgment in favor of the father was struck by the trial court, and the Supreme Court upheld that decision and said there was no, number one, no physician-patient relationship, but also number two, that there was no assumption of a duty in that case either, because there was no communication, because there was no affirmative conduct by the doctor that would give rise to assuming a duty. I also point out that in Burns, the cases that it cites, so Burns does say, I'll concede, when the issue is not whether the law recognizes a duty. And that sentence is important because in this case, this is a case asking the court whether or not the law recognizes a duty based upon the facts pled. So I would submit that this, the first part of the Burns case sort of exempts our particular issue. But
and that's because the default rule is there is no duty. Whereas in cases where the default rule is, of course there's a duty, like you're driving down the road and you're not supposed to be driving negligently. You don't have to plead you have a duty to drive reasonably down the road. The default rule is you do.
Correct. The quote goes on to say that the existence of that duty is a question for the fact finder. So counsel, the plaintiffs now argue, all we have to do is allege it, and it's a question of fact for the fact finder. This court has never held that duty is a question for the fact finder. Duty has always been, the existence of duty has always been a pure question of law. That's what the cases say over and over again.
Well, let me ask you a question, if I might. If you have somebody, a medical personnel, who's driving down the road and sees an automobile accident, they don't have a duty to stop and render aid. But if they do, they can't do it negligently. There's no problem figuring out how that's communicated. It's communicated the moment that the medical personnel actually does it to that particular person. This doesn't involve a communication to a particular person, but it raises the question as to whether or not the practice and behavior of, in this case, the taxi company, is such that it communicates to a class of people. Is that possible?
I would say no, it's not possible to communicate to an entire class of people. And that's a good point. The plaintiff is arguing that you have this duty not just to one person, not just to our employees, but you have this duty to an entire class of cab drivers. Everybody who's dispatched, you have now assumed a duty to protect their life and safety.
Well, suppose, and I don't know the evidence in the case, and nobody does because it hadn't been tried, but suppose there were witnesses in the case that would come forward and say, one of the reasons why we work with this cab company is it is well known that they really try to protect their drivers. They screen calls. They get a suspicious call. They'll call the cab back. They even call other cab companies, which, interestingly enough, is part of the allegations in this case. Would that, assuming that that could be proved and assuming that that is a part of either the pleadings or inferred from the pleadings, is that sufficient under our case law to establish a prima facie case of assumption of a duty?
I would say no, Your Honor. Because
why not?
Well, because it might be a nice place to work. There might be an employee-employer relationship, and that can be triggered as a special relationship where there are criminal acts by a third party, and that is a whole other body of law that the court has been sort of careful to rein in. So I think in that context, we could find ourselves here, but it would be a special relationship argument that we would be, or that they would be making.
You're right on the point. Is the special relationship individualized, or can it be to a class of people?
I believe that a special relationship can be defined to exist between an employer and an employee. I think that is one of the special relationship cases. Like the AH versus Rockingham case, I believe the court assumed that there was a special relationship in that case. That's a case where
That's a great example, because there was a paper boy, as
yes,
it were.
Sir.
But the question was, did the newspaper people, the supervisors, do this not just for this paper boy, but did they do it for the entire class of paper boys that were out there?
That's right. And, but the point I was going to make with that is, we're not here on a special relationship case, but in that case, the court actually said, assuming that there is a special relationship and that a duty could exist, it doesn't exist. There is no duty to warn, because this third-party criminal act is so unforeseeable in that particular
case. And if they had said, for example, to the parents of these young people, don't worry about it, because we're going to watch your kids. We're going to take care of them. We're going to make sure that they're provided some kind of protection as they're out delivering papers in the early morning hours. Suppose that was the evidence, and that it was communicated to an entire class of people, namely the parents of the kids who were paper boys.
What? If it was communicated, a duty could be assumed.
Well, there you go. That's one step. It was communicated. The first question is it possible, even if it is communicated? And I'm guessing your answer is yes, it's possible if it's communicated.
It is. And to be clear, in that Rockingham case, assumption of duty was an issue in that case. And this court said, we declined to impose these additional duties upon Rockingham merely because it took precautions not required of it. So that case is worth a look. Your Honor,
you're going to get in the hot water with your co-counsel.
Thank you.
So let him come up here.
Thank you.
Good morning. Brian Casey for Reginald Morris. A complaint must allege facts that give rise to a duty, even an assumed duty. And the jury then gets to determine if the alleged facts are true. Here, the plaintiff didn't allege facts that Mr. Morris, my client, undertook to render services to protect Mr. Ambruster. The duty claimed in the complaint that was assumed is a duty to warn. And the negligence claimed is a breach of the duty to warn, and that's at paragraphs 27I, 48, and 44. So we have to ask ourselves the question, are there facts alleged in the complaint that indicate that Mr. Morris assumed a duty to Mr. Ambruster to warn him about his killer? And we look in the complaint, and there's no communication by Mr. Morris with anyone regarding Mr. Ambruster, not with Mr. Ambruster himself, not with anybody else about Mr. Ambruster. And there's no affirmative act or undertaking on the part of Mr. Morris with regard to Mr. Ambruster.
And I know you have limited time, but picking up on the line of questioning that the chief was asking, Mr. Morris was recording in some type of logbook suspicious calls from this number, from this location, from this place. Can't you infer that he was writing that down so that the next time this call comes in, the next cab driver who gets dispatched to this call would have that information?
What's missing there is that you don't have any allegations of fact indicating that Mr. Morris was assuming a duty toward Mr. Ambruster by writing down those things in the law.
For whom would he be writing it down? For what purpose would you record this information if not to warn the cab drivers who are going to be dispatched?
Well, there's a log that's required, I believe, by the city to be kept of the dispatcher's activities. I don't know if that's there's a mention of that.
Of suspicious places, numbers, and phone calls.
I don't know if it requires that or not. The allegation in the complaint is that Mr. Morris wrote down what had occurred the night before in a log for use by others. But there's no allegation of fact in the complaint that he communicated or anyone communicated to Mr. Ambruster that Mr. Morris was doing this in an effort to undertake to render services to protect Mr. Ambruster, which is the restatement requirement. So the fact that what's missing is the fact of the undertaking of Mr. Morris specifically to protect Mr. Ambruster from his killer. We don't have that allegation in the complaint, and my time is expired.
Mr. Casey, ordinarily when cases come up here and you have different issues that are being divided up, and somebody gets to your point, time's up. But you represent a different party altogether. You have 2 more minutes.
Thank you, Ron. I appreciate that. The point I was making is that Mr. Morris neither agreed to warn Mr. Ambruster. He neither, and unlike the communicated agreements in Kellerman and Dodato and Burns, Mr. Morris made no agreement with anybody, no communication with anybody, no action like in the Nolte Brothers case or in the Dodato case where there was actual medical care rendered. The restatement section 323 predicates the assumption of duty on undertaking to render services to another which he should recognize as necessary for the protection of the other's person. And we just don't have an allegation of an undertaking on the part of Mr. Morris to render services to Mr. Ambrister. There's certainly an allegation that Mr. Morris, the night before, rendered services to a different cabbie when he called that cabbie's dispatch off because of a troubling series of phone calls, and that he wrote down and logged that information in a log, that's alleged in the complaint, and that he contacted another cab company to advise them about the troubling series of phone calls. But none of that indicates that he assumed a duty to Mr. Ambrister.
See, the way the restatement is worded and the way the common law backdrop works is that the bridge is crossed when the conduct or the volunteerism rises to the point where the actor believes, I'm now taking on a compulsory duty that I don't have to do, but I know that I'm doing it, and the communication point is solemnizing that to some extent, as opposed to just trying to help someone out and not making yourself legally liable for the rest of your life on the subject. And isn't that gray zone difficult to police?
It is difficult to police, but the restatement, which was adopted in Burns, says that the person who's assuming the duty has to recognize or should recognize that the services are necessary for the protection of the other person, and we just don't have any allegations of fact pleaded that Mr. Morris recognized anything with regard to Mr. Ambrister at all. No conduct, no actions, no rendering of services on Mr. Ambrister's behalf to protect him from his killer. And my time is up now.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal.
I should begin by pointing to a few points in the pleading that I think respond adequately to some of their contentions. Paragraph 27G talks about the purpose of the logbook for the subsequent dispatchers and employees and or agents of the defendants to use and review. 27I says that it's to identify the number for increasing the risk of harm to Peter and the cab drivers. Paragraph 52 specifically alleges that Peter's death was suffered because of his reliance on the undertaking. If he didn't know about the undertaking, he couldn't very well rely upon it.
Well, now, can I ask this question? Because my question is to opposing counsel pose the issue, which would be a legal issue. Can this assumption of a duty be to a class of people? And if it is, you clearly have the class of the people referred to under subsection I. But can it be a communication to a class of people?
I can't see any reason why it wouldn't be applicable to a given group. A Boy Scout troop, for example, could issue either an express or an implicit assumption that we will take care of your Cub Scouts. And that doesn't apply to Jimmy and Billy and Bobby. It applies to all the Cub Scouts. I don't see the same thing with any other class that is reasonably identifiable, such as these cab drivers are. There's no reason you have to go individually one by one any more than, in order to get liability, I would have to prove that Morris said to Pete Ambrister and every other cab driver, I got your back on this case. I got your back on this one. I got your back on this one. It doesn't work that way.
Wouldn't the Boy Scout example be a special relationship hypothetical as opposed to a pure assumption of the risk?
It may very well be. I'm not going to try to assert that they're a loco parentis in this situation. All I meant to do was to illustrate that it is possible to owe a duty to a class of people, and that's perfectly natural. You don't have to go one by one and make an individual promise or even an implicit promise in order to be liable for that. If you undertake to protect the class, and the class knows about it and relies upon it, then I think you're liable in each of those circumstances. And I think I can wrap this up fairly quickly and give you back some change from your 15 minutes. There's one other thing that I want to mention, and that is Mr. Merrick's suggestion that when he compared this to your son or daughter going on a ski trip and saying that they've undertaken to do their homework, but that doesn't mean they've completed it. Forgive me for saying this starkly, but that's why Pete Ambrister is dead, because they undertook to perform a duty and they didn't complete it. All we've alleged is that they specifically undertook to do to perform a duty, as in Kellerman, as in Burns. I'm not going to even go to Tabota because that was legally imposed. But these are specific instances where this court has held, as a matter of fact, these people have undertaken a duty, or at least allegedly have done so.
What about the other spouse in Kellerman? Why did we let that other spouse go?
Because he wasn't present at the time. He didn't do anything in order to
do the kids were in his home. He was obviously not trying to hurt anybody, and one might assume that, of course, if you're there, and it was pled, he invited in the home, that you would expect the safety to be given. And we held as a matter of law, you can plead it all day long, it's just not enough.
Right, the undertaking was made at the exchange of the children when Mrs. McDonough, I believe it is, said, we'll make sure that we'll take care of it, there won't be any boys driving the car.
But the allegation was, well, that was implied by the dad, too. And from your perspective, I don't know why that wouldn't be a reasonable allegation or a reasonable extrapolation, but we said no, that's not enough.
Well, I know that there was an allegation that he owed that duty, but I don't recall, you may recall the pleadings better than I do because I haven't read the pleadings in that case. I do know that Mr. McDonough, I think is who it was not present when the exchange was made, and so therefore could not have undertaken to do that. And there certainly is no indication that the Kellermans entrusted his undertaking to do that. We do have that in this case.
Where is the communication in this case?
Well, let me start with the easiest answer, which is it is implicit by the fact in paragraph 2 he relied upon it. So he obviously knew about it. I'm not going to tell you that there was an express statement because I can't stand here and say there's in the record here a statement that on January the 12th they said, we got your back.
Yeah, but these are two, it seems to me, two different questions. Mr. McDonough, the question there was, who undertook the duty? The question here is, who did the duty extend to?
Okay.
And that, I mean, that's a friendly question, by the way.
I recognize it.
I'm not sure that the answer to the McDonough hypothetical actually is pertinent to what your claim is in this case.
Right, because we're asserting that there is a group of people that these promises expressly apply to, paragraph 27. We're doing this for the safety of the other people who work here, for the other dispatchers, so they can protect.
And it's a commercial relationship on an ongoing basis, as distinguished from a kid who shows up in a home for an evening.
That's true. Let's questions. I think I've exhausted.
Well, I'm not sure you answered Justice McClanahan's question.
He did.
Okay. I guess the question I have is the establishment of the duty on behalf of the individual. I understand if cab company says we're going to take care of all cab drivers, where is the duty that's undertaken by their employees who do that, who dispatch?
Well, he's the one who actually undertook to perform this duty. He's the liability of Irish Fleet is respondeat superior in this case. He's the one, he's the class of dispatchers. He wouldn't be the only one.
What established his duty to the drivers as opposed to his duty to his employee to do whatever the employer tells him to do?
The fact that he knew that was for their protection, and that as this asserts, that could reasonably be relied upon by the cab driver saying, they're looking out for me. They've got the dangerous call screen, so it's okay for me to do this.
So if a security guard does something wrong and the whole point of the relationship is to provide security, he negligently performs his job, he can be sued as well as his employer?
I don't see why not, if he's the person individually who neglects something that he's undertaken to do. But this is the pleadings at least allege that both the individuals and the company did it. And evidence could come out to prove that or disprove it, but we have to wait for a trial for that.
You mentioned Irish Fleet. The theory there is entirely vicarious liability, respondent superior?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you for your interest in this case.
All right. Thank you all for your arguments. Very interesting case. Call the next case.